Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Does a college education benefit the recipient, or is it a public good that benefits society? That question is at the heart of the new film, Starving the Beast, The Battle to Disrupt and Reform America's Public Universities. Since 1980, state funding of public universities has plummeted, with a corresponding increase in tuition and student debt. The documentary looks at both sides of the funding power struggle that's unfolding on college campuses across the country. Many say it's one of the nation's most important and least understood fights. We'll talk about that with Bill Bonosky, producer of Starving the Beast, and Matt Jordan, an associate professor of media studies at Penn State. The documentary has been making the rounds in college towns across the country since it premiered this past March. Professor Jordan was instrumental in getting the film to State College. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So I'll begin with you, Bill. Together with writer and director Steve Mims, a professor at the University of Texas, you produced a very powerful documentary that examines both sides of the story of education reform, beginning with the precipitous decline of state funding and the corresponding increase in tuition and student debt. You have called this a passion project. What inspired you to tell this story?
Well, Steve and I live in Austin, Texas, and we were watching some very unusual things unfold at the Board of Regents level at the University of Texas back in 2011 or so. And in Texas, as in many states, the governing boards of the universities are appointed by the governor, and our governor, Perry, at the time, had a notion that the way that our two flagship universities in Texas, Texas A&M and University of Texas at Austin, were operating were not in line with the way that they should be operating, that they should be run more like a business, and we should treat the students more like customers and educate many more people at less cost. And there were issues about separating research from teaching mission and potentially moving research into the private sector. All of these things were bubbling up in the public eye, and it was unusual because these things that happen at board levels of universities typically are not dramatic, and these were dramatic events unfolding. What was most interesting about it, in Texas, we saw that this was not a red-blue political issue, because whether you were a Democrat or Republican, conservative or progressive, if you were a graduate of the University of Texas at Austin, you have a deep feeling for the place, and a lot of these changes that were being attempted to be implemented at the time by the governor and his appointees to the Board of Regents were really at odds with the way that many of these folks who went to those schools thought should be.
Well, you say it's not a red and blue issue, but if you look at the six universities that you focus on in your documentary, the University of Wisconsin, UVA, the University of North Carolina, LSU, the University of Texas, and Texas A&M, as you mentioned just a moment ago, the governors in those states, many of whom became primary Republican presidential candidates, have all been Republicans.
Well, it is political, for sure, the issue. What I was meaning is not red and blue issue in terms of the alumni, the students, the faculty
members. Who's concerned about it?
Concerned about it.
Okay. And everyone's concerned about it.
But absolutely, it was a political issue, and that's been borne out across the country.
Well, the film poses the question, really, should individuals and businesses bear the financial burden of sustaining these publicly funded universities because they are the beneficiaries? Or should that fall on society as a whole because we all benefit when our populace is educated? You've spent years with Steve Mims researching and making this film, and I really want to know, what did you learn? How do most Americans come down on that question?
Well, and you asked earlier about a passion. It's also a passion project for me in the sense that I grew up in the industry of higher education. My father was the president of a private university in California and a large public research university. So I've seen the impact that these universities can have on communities and on states and on people's lives. And so it was interesting to me and a passion project in that sense. I mean, what we have discovered in our almost 4 years in making this film is that there are smart arguments on both sides of this question. And we were very careful. We attempted to be as neutral as we could be to let each side say what they thought about these issues.
And critics said that. Most said that your treatment of this was very even-handed.
Well, we were fortunate because we were able to get the smartest people on
both sides,
really smart people. And each side has an argument. There's no question that public higher education is a highly inefficient enterprise, and efficiency can and should be brought to that enterprise. But it's also true that we as a country have benefited by our massive investment in public higher education. And for more than 150 years, we've made it a priority in our country to make great higher education available to anyone, regardless of financial means, who has the drive and the willpower and intelligence.
And many would say that the United States has been wildly successful because of this public investment in higher education. So I'll go to you, Matt Jordan. You've been teaching for several decades at this point, and I'm wondering from your position and from looking at this issue, what are the implications of viewing students as customers?
Well, I think there's two ways to think about that. First is that there are many customers of public education, and the student is one of them, but the other is the state. And this is what Jefferson had in mind when he started the University of Virginia, was that he thought that the state would benefit in commerce and in people studying science.
And of course, universities become economic engines for their states.
Completely. So that's the customer that's getting lost out of this equation is the what we would call a positive externality in economics terms to the public education equation. But then on the other side, the customer in terms of the student, we've lost sight of what the product is in a way. So we're talking about short-term gains in terms of vocational training for the jobs that exist now. And we've stopped talking about the long-term benefits for the product, right? What does it mean to live a rich life? What does it mean to gain wisdom in terms of your long-term goals, being happy? And lots of research would say that that should be the priority of education. Most people don't stay in their first job. And we all know from living that we have no idea what the job market's going to look like in 10 years. So in a way, when we de-emphasize that long-term goal of education being a broad education that's going to challenge people's virtues, going to allow them to imagine what the good life would be, we're weakening the product in a way that's, even if we think about it from the frame of the customer, in a way that's bad for everything.
Well, before we explore that a little bit further, I'd like to talk a little bit about why this has happened, because public investment in higher education peaked in 1980, and it has fallen precipitously over the last 35 years, and it happened in your state of Texas.
Well, it happened in the state of Texas. It happened in the state of Pennsylvania.
But it seemed to start there.
It really started in places like Illinois and places like California. I mean, there are places like Kansas. It's been a we can't really look to one state in our research and say, okay, here's where these ideas came from. Certainly, some of the disruption, these ideas of disruptive innovation applied to higher education. Some of those ideas may have come out of a think tank in Austin that was shown in the film, and some of these ideas of Governor Perry's appointees and a man named Jeff Sandifer, who was a supporter of Governor Perry's and was instrumental in writing this thesis about the seven simple solutions to changing higher education. And that, you know, that information was distributed widely, not just within the Texas public policy arena, which there's a basically conservative think tanks across the country adopt many of the same white papers, and you see some of the same things that were happening in Texas, happening, you know, showing up in Virginia and North Carolina and Wisconsin and so forth. So what happened is it just became, what we have found in our research is in 1980, with the trickle-down economics that were brought in under the Reagan administration, the same thought was given to all sorts of public spending, including higher education. And so if you were to point to any sort of origin, and we do this in the film, we would point to the Reagan Revolution in terms of the trickle-down economics and the idea that if we cut funding to state entities, then as a society, we'll be better off. There'll be greater economic stimulation and gain. And, you know, I don't know that the facts really bear that out.
Well, the irony of all of this is that this idea of treating students as customers, I think, led a lot of universities to try to attract them the way any business would, by providing more amenities, more services, dorms that were more like apartments, climbing walls and gyms and all those sorts of things. But I'm wondering, Matt Jordan, to what extent that explosion in amenities and catering to these customers has resulted in the increase in tuition and the ballooning of student debt.
I think there's something to that, that when you have to attract students in order to pay your bills, which we do, we know that if we're down 700 students a year at Penn State, that's a huge budget crunch, and we all feel the pressure of that, that you have to make sure that when they're going to visit these universities as customers, that you have the best climbing wall, that you have all this stuff. And again, this is because it's, I think, a short-term thinking. Like when Jefferson started universities, he was pretty convinced, as most thinkers have been on this, that students weren't going to know what they needed to know when they came there. That was the whole reason for a long training in the things that university was going to give you. But one of the things we do is we're pitching the experience to them, which is going to be fun, which is going to involve throwing frisbees, which is going to involve... But we're not telling them in a way what that the work is going to be, what the hard work and training that it's going to take to get them where they need to go.
And in fact, a number of Republican presidential candidates said that what universities need to do is tell students coming in, if you major in this, this is what you're going to become. These are your job prospects, and this is what you are going to earn. But what I'm wondering is, in a market-driven system, what happens then to professions like teaching, for example, which is not one of the lucrative degrees that our students can get? And yet, in the next decade, half of our teachers are going to be eligible for retirement.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is a false argument is that if you study liberal arts, that you're not going to be prepared for the existing jobs in the workplace or for jobs that don't even exist in the workplace. And I don't think that the employers are looking at it that way. My daughter graduated from the University of Virginia this last spring with a poetry degree, and she was hired with a very nice paying job from Oracle, Oracle is out seeking young people who have learned to read and write and think critically. And those are important attributes of a historically a liberal arts education. And so when you see these politicians say, well, we want to measure what value you're going to get from a poetry degree, I think that that's just not something that you can do, because
you don't know where it might
lead
you.
You don't know where that's going to lead you. And I'm grateful to the Commonwealth of Virginia that would invest in people to learn these things.
It's interesting, though, because the Ad Council, I think, in fear that students are monetizing all of their degrees, has come out with an ad called Make More. And it's not about making more money. It's about making a difference. And that's how they're selling an education degree to students. But I want to get to the title of your film, Starving the Beast, which is sort of a play on words. Explain what it means in the context of your film.
Well, in the context of our film, what we see is, and this shows up from some of our interview subjects, that if you want to fundamentally change a public institution from a political perspective, and really these are political issues, because all of the funding for these public higher education institutions comes from the politicians and from the state legislatures. And so if you want to fundamentally change something that you can't otherwise, then you can starve it to death. And that's the notion of the name Starving the Beast. And I don't think we suggest that there is any, you know, covert plan, you know, to actually ruin these universities. I think it's just, as we show in the film, there's just a philosophical difference of opinion on how you guys, you know, we're giving you way too much money. We're going to tighten it up, and then we're going to see some more efficient operations coming from you. And the other thing that's true is you see some ideological battles, and this really plays out in our film in the state of North Carolina. And the, you know, desire for the political right, if you will, to get inside and control some of the levers in these what are considered liberal state institutions.
That's right. And even when they are not state-funded programs, mm-hmm. they want to pull the plug sometimes. So if you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. A 35-year process of defunding public universities has coincided with soaring tuition costs and skyrocketing student debt. The documentary Starving the Beast looks at both sides of that power struggle, which fundamentally questions the nature and purpose of a college education. Our guests are Bill Bonosky, producer of Starving the Beast, The Battle to Disrupt and Reform America's Public Universities. The documentary has been screened in college towns across the country since it premiered this past March. Also with us is Matt Jordan, an associate professor of media studies at Penn State. He was instrumental in getting the film to State College. You mentioned something interesting, Bill Bonosky, that I want to follow up with Matt Jordan about, and that is they're not trying to starve these institutions so that they fail, and yet the reality is five universities in a 10-year period, an average of five universities close per year, and Moody's just predicted that in this current environment, it's going to triple to 15 colleges and universities closing their doors per year. How do you respond to that?
I'm a little less, I think that there is a design to starve these institutions. I think it's because these are also the people who are investing heavily in private for-profit universities on a lot of the times, trying to change the accreditation system to make those available. So there, in many cases, these are people who have a vested interest in seeing the public university die so that they get more customers. But it also has to do with power, right? This is political leverage to take away what has been a dissenting voice, a critical voice of politicians in the country. So, you know, since the 1970s, when universities were hotbeds of student liberalism and things like that were anti-status quo, you've seen a systematic, from that moment on, attempt to, you know, bring power to bear on that. And using economic levers is a great way to do it.
And some would say the goal may be to shuffle the deck and to get more conservative professors on campuses, because many are concerned that there's too many liberals on campus and influencing their students, their sons and daughters, in ways that they don't appreciate. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that's true with what we've seen in making this film. I think a good example is in North Carolina. We cover this in the film. The president of the University of North Carolina system was pushed out. He did nothing wrong, and they couldn't even give a reason as to why they were pushing him out. But they pushed him out, and they brought in someone with a much more conservative political ideology. So the idea is you start there, and then you can work your way into having, you know, a different type of political viewpoint within the, you know, the deans and then the faculty member, and you start, but it has to start with where they can control it, and they can control, the politicians control the boards, and then the boards can decide who's the president of the university, and then it sort of trickles from there.
And the argument is that there's a monoculture on college campuses, that with so many liberals, there is a dulling effect in terms of conversations about important issues, whether it's the Iraq War or college funding.
Well, you know, I don't know how to answer that. I think that, you know, there's something, the New York Times review of our film was really terrific, and we were actually the New York Times pick of the week, and the quote that the review started with was, you know, there's, what is it? It's the old joke, academic politics are so nasty because the stakes are so small. And so, you know, to that, that's kind of what I think about this, you know, idea of, you know, too much liberal thinking going along these universities. The real problem that we saw, and the real problem that is a result of the defunding of public higher education, which has been systematic for 35 years. I mean, when you look at funding from states going down from an average of 60% of a university's budget to 12% now, the real problem is, and forget about the climbing walls and the big football stadiums and all of that, and that's another film in and of itself. But the real problem is we have lost way of the original mission of these public universities, which is to make higher education available to everyone. And that's what and that's what's most sad about this, because people like my wife, who grew up in a farm in Northeast Louisiana and went to a small state school in Louisiana and then did well enough to get to be able to go to the University of Texas Law School and became a great success. That success story does not exist today. It's not possible now.
You know, you talk about this systematic defunding over 35 years, and the reality is that states now pay 50% less than they did 35 years ago, and students pay 500% more. You mentioned this 12%, that states now are contributing 12% of the operating expenses for universities, which means that 88% is coming from other sources, and universities are scrambling to get this money. And I'm wondering, to you, Matt Jordan, how concerned are you that, you know, deans and university presidents have to commit so much time to fundraising, and then they can be beholden to somebody who, you know, there are strings attached to this money I'm giving to your university?
Absolutely. And it also affects the conversation we're having about education, right? So instead of talking about, you know, Emerson talked a lot about education, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and his concern was that we made every topic, no matter what it was, relevant to students now, right? So it doesn't matter if it's 16th century poetry. If you're teaching it the right way, you can make it relevant now. And in many ways, that's what I think we should be doing, is how can we figure out the way to make whatever it is the expertise of the faculty know relevant now? But we're not having those conversations. We're talking about how can we have an online class that's going to bring in money for the department? How can we raise money from a donor? And our deans are doing that. And the message gets down to the level of the faculty. It all starts from the top in that economic coercion. Once you take away the ability to be free and think about these things and tell people, you got to find out ways to pay your own bills, that's going to be what everybody's talking about.
So what does all this mean for private institutions? And I ask that because 3/4 of those who get a college education get it from a public institution, not a private institution. But because there are fewer students and more people, more universities competing to get them to their campus, we find that last year, private institutions gave very often 48% discounts in tuition to attract them. So I'm wondering what this whole funding issue is having on them.
I think it's in many ways it's making a place like Penn State more expensive than a commensurate private institution, because we don't have the size of endowment based around student aid. We're desperately trying to catch up because we see where the competition's coming from. But I think it puts public institutions who have had to do this in 10 years, you know, at a very grave disadvantage.
Yeah. And what does this mean for the land grant mission? Especially if, you know, 88% of the funding is not coming from the state, as I said a moment ago, but from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And you got to remember where the land grant came from. And the land grant, the Morrell Act of 1862. So while the Civil War is going on, our Congress and our President Lincoln signed into law this law that basically provided funding to every state so that higher education could be made available to the next generation of Americans at an affordable price. What this is doing is it's entirely undercutting the Land Grant Act and the efforts made by those our forefathers in the late 1800s to set up a course to provide the best form of higher education in the world, in our country, and that's what we've done. The universities, our public university system, is the envy of the world. It has been that way for many decades, and we are losing our edge in that respect. And it is true, to echo what Matt said, the private universities have flourished during this 35-year period.
And in fact, they're sometimes poaching the public university's best faculty because the faculty member is afraid, for example, that something in their syllabus will get them fired.
Well, you have, and as we point out, one of our case studies is the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where the governor and the legislature this last year eliminated the protection of tenure from the statute. It was a statutory protection. They eliminated that. And as a result, what we're seeing is some of these private schools like Northwestern are poaching these faculty members because their jobs are no longer as protected.
There's evidence to suggest that if states restored funding to 2000 levels, that there would be, in Pennsylvania, for example, there would be a $4,000 decrease in tuition. And that would actually be more if you factored into that what students pay for student loans and on interest. Governor Tom Wolf has tried to restore funding in Pennsylvania, but the legislature has not allowed that to happen. I'm wondering, has there been success in other states, and can we anticipate, I mean, is this sort of like the manufacturing problem? Once those jobs are gone, they're gone. Once that funding is gone, it's gone.
Well, the big lever, and the film talks about this, are lobbying groups that are essentially racket businesses. It's like the mafia, you know, a protection racket. The Club for Growth, Pat Toomey's used to be president of it. He established this checklist, right, so that if you signed a pledge for life that you would never raise taxes.
Grover Norquist.
And so what you have is essentially it's the shock doctrine applied to academia and by extension. So you take away funding and then you threaten anybody that tries to do otherwise. Somebody like Thomas Jefferson would be appalled by this. He would say this is a withdrawal of our public responsibility, and that he tried to raise taxes, and he wouldn't be surprised at this. But what Jefferson worried about was that this was completely predictable in a society that the wealthy would want education only for their kids, right? This was what he worried about, was the conferring of power through something like the idea of a natural aristocracy. But the reason that he was so passionately in favor of public universities was because he believed in equality.
You have said, Bill Bonosky, that you would give a free ticket to any policymaker who would go see this film and then talk about it. And I'm curious to know just how widespread viewing of this film has been and what the reaction has been.
Well, we opened the film theatrically about 6 weeks ago. It's Labor Day weekend in Washington, D.C., and then we went to New York City, and then we went to Los Angeles and Dallas and Houston and Charlottesville and Raleigh, North Carolina. What we really wanted to do is we wanted to open the film in some of the major markets to get some national attention to the film, and then take it to some of the places that are most affected by it. Some of the places that we showed in the film, we opened it in Madison, Wisconsin, for example, in Austin, Texas. But the real demand for the film is coming from the colleges. And so we've been contacted now by over 700 people associated with colleges and universities all across the country and beyond. And we are, like what Matt has put together for us at the State Theater, we're doing that. We hope to be doing that over the next several months at colleges everywhere.
Matt Jordan, why did you bring the film to Penn State?
Well, it echoed so much of what I was seeing here. So, in 2011, Governor Corbett's first year, we had a $182 million cut to the budget, which was a shockwave that was repeated the next year and then the year after that. So in the years since then, this is all we've been talking about, is what do we do when we have to start cutting tissue from there is no fat left to cut. So what do we do as faculty? So this, we felt isolated, and one of the things about the story is you realize that this is part of a larger problem, it's part of a systemic problem, and that it's only until you start to understand what the problem is that you can try to figure out a solution.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That was Matt Jordan, an associate professor of media studies at Penn State, and Bill Bonosky, producer of Starving the Beast, The Battle to Disrupt and Reform America's Public Universities. To learn more or hear other interviews in the Take Note series, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.